This morning, we welcome our good friend Jesse Feiler to the program. He's our tech guru. He is a developer, consultant, and author specializing in Apple technologies. He is the creator of Minutes Machine for iPad, the meeting management app, and Saranac River Trail app, a guide to the trail that includes location-based updates as well as social media tools. It is always a great pleasure to have Jesse join us every month, and here he is for his January visit, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Hello, well, sir.
I'm thrilled too.
Excellent. So we talk about a lot of topics when you're here, and a lot of neat things. And but this one just has a cool name: Dark Software. Okay, yeah. And I believe in the billboard to this hour, I call it the dark shadowy world of dark software. Is it a dark shadowy world? Was I correct in that?
It sounds better. You make it sound
perhaps a little more nefarious than it actually is.
No, it's probably more nefarious. It's dark software joins. I was suggesting that. Dark may be the word of the year this year.
Yes.
Because, in fact, I heard this morning on an interview with about dark money.
Yes.
Which we're talking about.
Yes. Could be. Yeah. Jane Bryan Quinn.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Dark money. We have dark fiber underneath our streets.
Yep.
Lot dark is in. And dark software, people have started to talk about it. It's all the software that we don't know about or pay attention to or ignore. And it comes really in two flavors. There's the dark software that we use and we don't pay attention to because it's in and around the software we care about.
Okay.
So when we think about software, we think about the things we use and the things they do.
So we take it for granted.
And well, we take for granted the stuff that's all around that handles the little routine operations that we have that we worry about. And we have, I believe, a very good example of that that's happened within the last month. The Nest programmable thermostats, which are wonderful devices, fantastic. They learn when you come and go, the time to go. Move the temperature up, move it down. They're really, really great smart thermostats. And apparently in a software update back in December, new software was pushed out to the Nest thermostats because they're on the internet, of course. This is part of this newly wired environment. And something went wrong. And it took a while for it to happen. And I think what went wrong was it was running down the battery too fast.
Okay.
And it turned out a few weeks ago, people started to discover that their homes were a lot bit chilly.
Winter will do that without heat.
Yes. And people in other parts of the world discovered that their homes were a little too cozy. So seems as if it was something not in the heart of the software, but it might have been in the update that was running down the battery. And we know this because it's happened on other devices with other things, that an update has unintended consequences, and often it's not in the core part of the software.
So is another way of saying that we, an update, of that we take that code and we write it and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it, and basically, we're just cutting and pasting, and not entirely sure what we're doing.
Or we may be sure what we're doing, but some of this is routine code. I mean, some of the code, and I don't know we don't really know what happened with Nest. But it's the sort of code that a little chunk of code that might connect you to a specific website, and that chunk of code might be 5 or 10 lines of code, and it might be inside a programmable thermostat, it might be inside a word processor, it might be inside a web browser. It's routine, and it's a matter of cutting and pasting code from various places, which we do as we're developing now, particularly with shared software. And the danger comes when it's cutting and pasting and just customize this one word in line 2.
Yeah.
That's the trap. Because it's a routine operation and just, oh, cut, copy, paste, change one word in line two, and you're ready to go. Well,
but
one
wait.
Keystroke wrong in that word that you changed in line two, and as we seem to have seen, it may be ready to go. Everything may, all the tests may succeed for the software that people are focused on revising, but this little piece of environmental software that's out there that no one has ever cared about is a routine thing. It's worked. Some of these chunks of code have worked for 20 or 30 years, and suddenly one of them blows up. And it, the worst case is if it doesn't blow up, if it misfunctions, and 2 or 3 months or years later, you see, oh, it's been working wrong the whole time.
So can I make an analogy, and then you can tell me if this is a, if this analogy is apt.
I'm sure it will be apt.
Yeah, well, I don't know, actually, but it's just because we have heard so much over the last several days and weeks about our aging infrastructure, about the pipes, about you know, our water pipes, and about our bridges and our roads, and the infrastructure that we have. And it seems in many ways that that's sort of what you're talking about here. It's the things that we take for granted. We'll go, we'll pave the road, we'll do that, but we don't actually look under and see that, that the whole infrastructure is 20 or 30 years old and is starting to crumble, much like the pipes that we see that are starting to erode and cause all kinds of problems and washouts and so forth. So in that sense, is the code that we see that is old, that is being cut and paste and has been around for 20, 30 years, is it time to say, oh, we need to work on the infrastructure and spiff that up so it supports the new stuff?
To a certain extent, that's true. It's also true that we should just be aware of it and not just blindly reuse it. Because okay. Some of the 30-year-old code is just fine. There's no reason to worry about it. But this process, also, it gets, without reflecting in any way, shape, or form on any people in any part of this infrastructure, the tasks of moving these little chunks of code into the new app. Let me phrase that in the most positive way I can do it.
I love when you do that, yes?
I'm trying to be nice.
I know. You always are.
I'm trying to be nice. No, I'm not. The rock stars,
yes,
are the people who are writing the blockbuster headline functionality of the apps.
Right.
And these are the people, the unsung heroes, who are working often behind the scenes on the parts that aren't flashy but are essential. And this is not a matter of code. This is a matter of every part of our society, the people who we really rely on. Those jobs we often take for granted. So it's not just a technical issue.
So you make the point that if we look at what we have and what we don't use inside the software that we have, You can find some pretty interesting things, and let me just go by some categories that you have broken this up to. For example, word processing. If you're talking about bold or underlining or italics, you say that fewer keystrokes could produce better documents, better styles, but we tend to use what's right in front of us, right?
Yeah. Well, this is the other aspect of dark software. The first aspect is the process of reusing code and not paying attention to it.
Yes.
This is the user side of dark software, which is all of this software that we take that we don't even know about that's inside our apps. And it's not so much that it may fail or not work properly. It's that we don't use it. We buy or get a piece of software that has all this functionality, and yet again, it's the same thing. We look at the headline-breaking functionality of it, the rock star features of the software, and we don't bother looking at it to see, hey, what else have we got there
right.
that has come along for the ride, like styles in word processors, like relations in databases. People don't use databases and spreadsheets. They use about 10 or 15% of the functionality in those programs. And we've got all this stuff, and it's there, and it can blow up, just like anything could blow up. But this is standard code that's been around often for 30 years, and people just don't use it. And if they were to go into it, they've got it. It's sitting there on their computer. They might as well use it. But it's much easier for many people and for teachers and trainers to say, okay, well, we have this wonderful new piece of software. I'm going to show you how to use it. And they go back and they start from square one, as if, often as if people had never turned it on a computer before. But we should be, the bar is higher now. We can now start to say, hey, there are these other tools you should be using. Don't just work with what you're comfortable with because you've used it for 20 years.
Now, one of the things, that, and if I'm getting off topic, let me know, but it seems to me that so often when you get the new, as you say, the rock star stuff, and oh, this is the new part of the software, and you think, oh, this is great. It looks different. It's nice. It's very pretty. And now I swipe here instead of swipe there, and oh, that's all very nice. But what I have found is that there is very little information offered as to what is on there. Or what the changes are. I give Apple some credit. They have a new thing on the I got this with the, I guess, the 6S, which is tips. And you click on that, and then every day there's some sort of new tip, and then every day you can learn something new that your phone does, some new part of the software. And I think, oh, well, that's very cool. And I just downloaded a new operating system onto my computer, and I do the same thing. I go through the tips, and it shows me stuff, because otherwise I wouldn't know about these things. But there is so much that the little brain here can handle, as far as that you have to swipe down while you're hitting the L key three times.
Yes, and this is quite a challenge, and it's really difficult.
I mean, it's cool that it does that stuff. For example, here's a concrete example. I just got this new system, and it has something where you can divide and put two pages up on the screen. And so instead of like windowing it and going back and forth, you can look at both at the same time. I've now looked this up three times to remind myself how to get to it. Mm-hmm. Now, eventually, I'm sure I'll learn it, but I haven't yet because it is rather clumsy. It's cumbersome of how to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's not like simple, like press this button. It's a series of buttons.
But once you do it about three times, you've got it.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yes.
The challenge here, and it's a challenge for everyone, is that as developers, we work very, very hard. Developers and interface designers work very hard on making things clear and easy to understand. And there is, no matter how hard you work at this, there is some sense that we've made it clear. It's all there. Why should we explain it? Because we've done our bit. Well, where the dividing line is between putting it there in a way that is obvious.
Yes.
We think. And a way that people can use when they're thinking about something else.
So what do you think of as obvious? Because if you just get a computer in a box, or a phone in a box, or an iPad in a box, or a tablet in a box, and you take it out, and they sort of walk you through, how does that then become obvious? I'm not arguing. I do get frustrated, because sometimes I know it does cool stuff. I just can't always figure it out. I want to. I just don't find it perhaps as obvious as you do.
No, I think it's – I don't know the answer to that. No one knows the answer to that. When it comes to interface and what's in the interface, it's sort of like, you know, the old puzzle for kids, the drawing puzzle, find George Washington in the cornfield?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, you know, once you find George Washington in the cornfield, that's all you can see is George Washington.
Right.
Because it's so obvious.
Yes.
Making that transition from seeing the cornfield to seeing George Washington is something I'm not certain anyone understands how to do.
That's a good point. And when you see somebody else do it, that helps.
Yes.
When you see kids usually do it. That helps. But sometimes it just can be... I feel this way about video games, too, of like, how did they know that that secret room was there and those coins were under that sofa?
Well, sometimes you don't know. It's a guess, and that you put clues there to get people to think, look under the sofa, just as in real life, if you're desperate enough to pay the pizza delivery guy, you'll find the real coins under the real sofa.
Right.
You have to be desperate.
Yes, you have to be desperate and have to have some time on your hands.
Yes, and the door has to be wide open, letting the cold air in.
So in the minute that we have left, how do we make this dark software? It seems what you're saying is we should shine light on the dark.
Yes, and there are lots of ways of doing that, and it's a topic of conversation in the world of software development. And in fact, on the website, I have a link to Ian Foster's paper about how they're using it with extreme computation in science, how they're trying to focus on all of the project, including what he calls on-ramps and off-ramps, this environmental software that is so important.
The website that Jesse's referring to is his. It's northcountryconsulting.com, northcountryconsulting.com, and he is nice enough to post many, many links on there about all that we have talked about this morning, and you can check this out and look at it in great detail. NorthCountryConsulting.com. Jesse Filer provides consulting services to small businesses and nonprofits. Jesse, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.